Let me take just a moment and thank Greg for speaking last Sunday night on very short notice. And it lets me know that if tonight I start feeling less than the best, I can just call on him and he's going to come right up here and take my place and go along without a hitch. I appreciate that. I'm grateful for that. Seriously, I'm grateful for that. I'm feeling pretty good. And 2 Samuel chapter 5, we take up from chapter 4 where Israel lost its head. What head did Israel lose, the northern tribes? I think I heard a whisper.
Ishbosheth,
yes. How did they lose the head of Ishbosheth? Well, quite literally, and also then by virtue of having no head, he couldn't reign. That left Israel without any viable candidate to take his place. Saul is dead. Jonathan is dead. Abner is dead. And now Ishbosheth is dead. Not one of Saul's descendants can take over. David already has governed a large part of Israel. And he's done it either through serving Saul in battle are acting as king over Judah for these 7.5 years. He's already proven himself over a large portion of Israel then. And we notice also that the Philistines and Canaanites are gearing up to attack. While there's civil war going on, they don't do a lot. Because, as Machiavelli said, if your enemy is destroying himself, what should you do? Let him stab his way. If he's killing himself, let him do it. That's what Israel's doing. They're having a civil war. But now they've all come together. So the Philistines rightly conclude, now they're going to be more powerful than ever. They'll get just stronger as time goes on. We need to hit while we can. It's in Israel's best interest then to unite behind David as king. So that's what we see in these opening lines of chapter 5. Verse 1 says, "Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, 'Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, "You shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel."'" In verses 1 and 2, I see three reasons why the Israelites, the northern tribes, say, "David, we're turning to you. We give you the crown, and we expect good things from it." What would you say those three reasons are? First one's in verse 1. "We are of your bone. We are your bone and your flesh." What does that mean? We're kin. We're all the sons of Jacob. Now, you remember Deuteronomy 17, verse 5. Has already warned, we've gone back to this several times and hope to again this evening. But Deuteronomy 17, I think I said 5, it's 15. 17, 15. "You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren." That means of my bone and of my flesh, doesn't it? "You shall set his king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother." Well, here in verse 1, these people are spot on. You are our relative. That's the first thing. What's the second reason? And this is found in verse 2. "In time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in." Go back to 1 Samuel 18 for just a minute. 1 Samuel 18:30. This is after Saul has become afraid of David because of the incident with Goliath and the people singing the song about how David has slain his 10,000s. 1 Samuel 18:30, "That the princes of the Philistines went out to war. And so it was, whenever they went out, that David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed." What kind of leader was David? He was a man who knew what to do. He was a man who did not lose his head in battle. And he was a man who pursued the best interest of his people at all times. That's a leader. They remember that. He became famous among his people. So that's the second thing they bring up there. "You were the one." Now they could have mentioned many other generals. I get the impression from 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, there was nobody who had the capabilities of leading in battle as David. Now, the Philistines, they're concerned about the Philistines. What do they want? Someone very capable. Why do they want someone capable? Well, we've just read in 1 Samuel 30 and 31 what happened to Saul and Jonathan and his sons. What did the Philistines do? They chase them down, they fire the arrows, they slay them. Israel's without a head again. They don't want that to happen another time. Twice is enough. So, that's the second reason. You're our kin, verse 1. You've shown yourself in battle, verse 2. Then the third reason is the reason. It is the ultimate reason. And that's the latter part of verse 2. And the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel. That pretty well nails it down, doesn't it? That tells them, if the Lord said it, you don't even need the other two reasons. He knows what's best, but we certainly do agree with God's reasons. Now, let's talk for a moment about what it means to be a shepherd. Yes, everything is working well. Cold weather seems to help these things. A shepherd. When you think about a shepherd, as it's used in the Old Testament, Genesis 49:24, in the blessing of Joseph, his father Jacob says, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And then he says, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. The true shepherd behind the salvation of his son Joseph is God, is what he's saying. Numbers 27, verses 16 and 17. Again, in Moses' prayer, let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. And we've talked about sheep without a shepherd and how fatal that is every time. He says, don't let that happen to my people. 2 Samuel 7:7. Which you have just right here in our context, the parallel being 1 Chronicles 17:6. Wherever I have moved about with all Israel, have I ever spoken a word to any of the judges of Israel? This is God speaking to David, whom I commanded to shepherd my people. You know those judges? Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, and so on. Those were shepherds appointed by God. Judges were shepherds over God's people. Did I say to anything of those judges, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? And he's explaining why his silence means David shouldn't try to do that. Then 1 Kings 22. We could spend a lot of time on this, but we won't. This is Micaiah speaking to Ahab. And you remember that Ahab has said, I'm going to go to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper because all these hundreds of prophets of Baal told me it's okay. That's good enough for me. And so he says, this is 22:17. I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. Now, who was their shepherd? Ahab. What does he mean they have sheep without a shepherd? He's gone. He's going to die. And the Lord said, they have no master, let each return to his house in peace. Now, what do we mean is the work of a shepherd? A shepherd protects his sheep. 1 Samuel 17, you see David referring to that. He said, when this lion, when this bear came against my sheep, I outran everybody in the country to get away. Is that what he said? No, Jesus said in John 10, the hireling runs, but the true shepherd stays and dies for his sheep. David risked his life to fight a lion and a bear. And he says, now I know I can take this Goliath who's threatening the flock of God, the sheep of God. So Jesus is the ultimate illustration of a shepherd in John 10. He rules the sheep. You see this in 2 Samuel 7 that we just read. And then he leads the sheep. You see that in Psalm 23. He leads me beside the still waters. He takes the sheep. Sheep don't know what they need. They wander off. They get in trouble. They need to be rescued constantly. They have to be patched up. And they have to be put to bed at night and taken out in the morning. And all these things. He leads his sheep where they need to go. He feeds his sheep. Isaiah 40 verse 11. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young. Notice, he will feed his flock like a shepherd does. He takes them where the good grass is, and then they go to the still water to drink. The Lord's care for his people sets a very high standard for any shepherd. And so he says to the shepherds, like John 10, you had others who came before me. They were thieves and robbers. They came to kill and to destroy. I came to give my life to die for these sheep. I came to die for these sheep. I want to save these sheep. 1 Peter 5, verses 1 and 2. When Peter begins to speak about elders, he uses the same figure, because the same figure you had in the Old Testament of shepherds taking care of their flock, you have in the New Testament. 1 Peter 5, 1. The elders who are among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers. Then he goes on telling them how they're to do this. Now, one more thing they do, they bring the sheep home. Interestingly, I find this fascinating every time I see it. Isaiah 44, verse 28, Cyrus, King Cyrus, was a shepherd of God. Cyrus was a shepherd. Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple, your foundation shall be laid. You see, Israel had had all these false shepherds, bad kings. They wouldn't listen to God. They got worse and worse. And he said, I'm taking you away from this. I'm sending you off into exile. I'm going to let it purge you, and the remnant will return. And the way that remnant will return is a foreign shepherd named Cyrus will say, last part of 2 Chronicles, Ezra, you are going to bring my people home. You're going to send them back. You're going to furnish them with things they have need of. And so the remnant returns. What a joyous day that is. He served as God's shepherd, sending the flock to their native grass. Now, one more. It works for the benefit of the sheep. Ezekiel 34 is one of the saddest chapters in all of the Old Testament. We don't have time to go into detail here, but I urge you to read it on your own. The Jewish rulers were just like Saul, only probably worse because there are more of them. And these people neglected and misused the sheep. They saw the sheep as a means of fleecing them for what they can get out of them. And so he says in verse 2, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord God to the shepherds, woe to the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flock? You eat the fat and clothe yourselves with the wool. You slaughter the fatlings, but you do not feed the flock. And the weak you haven't strengthened. They haven't done the job that they were supposed to do. They have done criminal acts they were not supposed to. And then after this, he gets into the messianic fulfillment of what the true shepherd will do. This gets us to John 10 again. Chapter 34, verse 23 of Ezekiel, I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. And as he uses that time's coloring to say, now what David was, what he brought to you, you're going to have another David who comes along and does exactly the same thing, only it will be a descendant of David as well as the Lord of David, who will do even more than David. He'll be the sinless Savior, the Son of God, of the seed of David. So he says, there'll be my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd. In 37:24, David my servant shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd. Now, the premillennialist says, well, what this means is David will be raised. He'll serve as a shepherd for some time, and then Jesus will come and he'll take his part. Well, if you do it that way, you have two. This is, there'll just be one. So if this is David, and David means David, then guess what? Jesus never gets to reign. Obviously, and even the premillennialists will tell you, when they get backed into a corner like that, this is referring to Jesus. And so when you look at it, they shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. So that sets the scene for what we're seeing here in 2 Samuel chapter 5. These people sorely need a shepherd. And notice in verse 2, a synonym of the word shepherd. What is it? Ruler. He shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel. That's what David was to be. Now in verse 3, therefore all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. Okay. First time he was anointed was, who did it? Samuel. Yeah, 1 Samuel 16. Who was the second time when David was anointed? What was he anointed over? When did it occur? Well, that'd be in chapter 2, wouldn't it? Who did it? Who was he king over for 7.5 years? Judah. Now, the third time he's being anointed, who's he king over this time? The whole nation of Israel. The northern tribes, the southern tribes, and everybody in between. So it says here, they anointed David king over Israel. He had a long, patient wait, didn't he? Wait training is one of the most difficult things a child of God does. Wait training is difficult. But he passed the test. He waited. And he got what God planned for him. Now, in verse 4, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. Numbers 4, verse 3, the priests were typically 30 when they began to reign. I remember someone else was 30, about 30, when he began his public work. Any ideas who that would be? Jesus, yes. I knew the name, but I couldn't pull it out. Luke 3, being as some suppose the son of Joseph, being about 30 years of age. I think that's Luke 3:23. And so you see here, David's about that age. In verse 5, it breaks it down for us. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. So obviously this book is written after his reign because he tells you how it ended and how many years he was ruler, right? Okay? Now, he's just brought up Jerusalem. So that raises the question, well, how did he get Jerusalem? Because from early on, neither the Benjamites nor the people of Judah were able to capture and hold on to Benjamin. They got it for a little while and lost it. So in verse 6, the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites. The Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David saying, you shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you, thinking David cannot come in here. Okay, a couple points about verse 6. It's kind of loaded. The king and his men. Who are the king and his men? The king's David. So who are the men? His mighty men. His men that he's had about 600 of them all this time fighting. So they haven't gone anywhere. They're still with him. So that's one thing. They went to Jerusalem. Back in Judges 19. Judges 19. You remember the occasion where the concubine of the man was brutally murdered in one of the towns of Benjamin. He'd wanted to stay in Benjamin because he thought it would be safe there. Judges 19:10. However, the man was not willing to spend that night, so he rose and departed and came to opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. So it was called Jebus. Jebusalem was the area that was controlled by the Jebusites. And he tells us, with him were the donkeys and so on. They were near Jebus, verse 11. The day was far spent. And he said, let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it. And his master said to him, we will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We'll go into Gibeah. And so they go into Gibeah thinking the city of Israel would be safer than this foreign city. So the Jebusites, or Jebusalem, because of the Jebusites, became Jerusalem instead. So this choice of this city to be the throne is a masterstroke because it's neutral. It's not owned exclusively by Benjamin. It is not owned exclusively by Judah. And so it can be very impartial. It's a place right in the middle of both kingdoms. So nobody will say, well, if you stay in Hebron, you're obviously in favor of what happens down in the south. If he goes up to Samaria, you're obviously in favor of what happens up there, not in your home. But here, it's neutral. So it's an excellent choice. And then furthermore, the people who lived in Jerusalem were a little bit cocky. They're a little bit sure of themselves. And they make this challenge to David. You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you. In other words, we don't need healthy fighters to keep you and your pipsqueaks out of this city. We'll set up blind men and crippled folks. And they can take their stick and just beat you down this hill. No way you're going to make it up here. So it's just child's play. So, verse 7, nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. Now we need to talk for a moment about the city of David. What is the city of David? Any answer you give, it can be contradicted. But not really. Look at Luke 2. And you'll see it in various other places. 1 Samuel 20, for example. But Luke 2. Look at verse 11. Luke 2, 11. For there is born to you this day in the city of David a Savior who is Christ the Lord. The city of David. What city was David born in? Bethlehem. That's the city of David. This calls it the stronghold of Zion. That is the city of David. We have a problem here, don't we? How do we reconcile this obvious contradiction? Whenever you see an obvious contradiction, you just say, yes, I'm about to learn something great. So, what do you learn here? What is it? How can it be more than one? There's probably 20, if I had to guess, but yeah. That's getting to it. Why was Bethlehem called the city of David? He was born. That's his birthplace. Why was Jerusalem called the city of David? He conquered it. Now, let me illustrate this. Seleucus Nicator, who was one of the generals of Alexander, he went up to Syria. He founded about 60 cities. He named 16 of them after his father, Antiochus. When you go to Antioch of Pisidia, Antioch of Syria, and all these other Antiochs, guess where they came from? This man's father. Alexander named about 70 cities after himself, the most notable being Alexandria, Egypt. And he named one after his horse, Bucephalus. It was called Bucephala. So, you can do anything you want to if you come in and conquer a city and say, you're going to listen to me, by the way, you're going to wear my name now. And they say, yes, sir. Anything you say. So, you can have 60 names or 70 names with some of these folks. It's not any problem for David to have two named after him. One because of his place of birth, the other because he conquered it. Okay, so that's not really a contradiction at all, is it? Then in verse 8, David said on that day, whoever climbs up. See, they've given this challenge. The crippled and the lame and the blind, they'll keep you out. We don't need real soldiers. He said, whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Therefore, they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. Okay. When you read in verse 8 this business about the water shaft, that's one of the most controversial words in the Old Testament. They have debated this ever since Warren back in the 1870s came to this place, got into archaeological digs and said, here's a shaft. I'm going to name it Warren Shaft. I wonder why he named it Warren Shaft, by the way. It wasn't that before, but that's what he did there. And so people have debated back and forth on this for many years. Now, Steve's been taking Biblical Archaeology Review for a long time. I think it was 84, 85, they had a big article on this. What about this water shaft? Is that what this word means? It only occurs two times, I think, in the Old Testament. And you don't have enough to really be able to be certain about it if you don't have a lot of uses of it. So, what are we going to say about this? Well, what you come up with is something like this. This would be what Jerusalem looks like about that time. And you'll see in another picture here what they call Warren Shaft. This is a very, very, very steep embankment here. But they were able to climb up through one of these things. And they said, it looks like it was chiseled out. Then somebody else says, no, we have all the evidence here. Geologists say it looks like it was natural, just open. And some said it was a water shaft. Some said, no, it wasn't a water shaft. I don't know. The experts don't know, so I guarantee you, I don't know. They don't know. But there was some kind of either a water tunnel or an opening, a fissure of some sort, that allowed Joab to climb up, apparently with men following him. He wasn't afraid to poke his head up first and see what he could do. And he takes care of the people up there and dispatches them with great force. And the city becomes David. Now, it doesn't tell us what he did with all these folks who had jumped on him and made fun of him. But that's all I know to say about that. You have anything, Steve? Okay. Tim, is your hand up?
Yeah, I was just wondering if with the Mormons.
Yeah.
They tried to explain their error about the prophecy where Jesus would be born by doing some hand maneuvering in the city of David.
It is a very common thing for them to try to do that. Were they at your house doing this?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Did they see the point?
The young boy did. It was with the older
one. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the, you know, as they pair them up, one experience. Yeah, yeah. All you do is try. Another thing, we need to go to 1 Chronicles chapter 11 to show the parallel to this, because it adds some things that aren't given here in 2 Samuel chapter 5. 1 Chronicles 11. Verse 4 says, David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. That's 1 Chronicles 11:4. But the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, you shall not come in here. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. You'll notice here's authorized agency. Whoever goes up and takes this will be rewarded. He'll be the chief of my army. David is given the credit because he's the general in charge. The general doesn't go out on the front line and do everything, but he sends the troops around and has them do things and plots the strategy. So in verse 6, David said, whoever attacks the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first and became chief. Joab has a bad temper. He's temperamental. He kills innocent people. But he is a vicious soldier. And if you had to fight an enemy like the Philistines, you want him on your side. Or somebody like the Jebusites, you want him on your side. Maybe then put him in prison afterwards. But then verse 7, David dwelt in the stronghold, therefore they called it the city of David. Ah, well, that's why they call it the city of David. How about that? And then he built the city around it from the Millo to the surrounding area. Now, the Millo, we'll go back to this chart. Is this area over here where the land needs built up? It needs mounding. And so the terrace is there where they built it up so it wouldn't flow down because of irrigation and irritation and all that. It would be able to stand. And so that's all I can tell you about the Millo. That was at some time a point of controversy. I don't think it is anymore. Okay, any comments about this before we proceed? Steve.
It's kind of interesting, verse 7 back in 2 Samuel. And then also it was noted in 1 Chronicles too, that after the threat was made and the tough talk where the Jebusites say, well, our land is going to take you guys either. It's interesting how that tidbit is put in there. Nevertheless,
excellent. Actions speak louder than words, especially when the Lord's behind those actions. Yeah, very good point. Any others? Matt.
Considering the last person who challenged Joab and dead, I wonder if anybody was a big hurry.
They suddenly became very slow climbers and slow runners, didn't they? I imagine that's right. I hadn't even thought of that either. Okay, very good. Anybody else? Okay. In, let's see, verse 9. Then David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built all around from the Millo and inward this terraced construction, this mound fortification. So David went on and became great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him. So David continues to make progress, success. Psalm 46 shows one of David's own psalms in which he gives his credit to the Lord for everything he is. Psalm 46 at verse 5. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her. Why is she immovable? Because God is in her. Verse 7. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. He's with us. Verse 11. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. If God is on your side, you need fear no enemy. Okay. In verse 11, then Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons, and they built David a house. David now is becoming so well known, notorious in a good sense, that he's being recognized by fellow kings in other areas. This Hiram and his offspring will build this house for David. They will later build for Solomon, his house. They'll have these contracts with the children of Israel for at least 80 years, I know. And it tells us that here's the source of David's success in verse 10. The Lord God of hosts was with him. Then Because God had made him what he was, even people of the world began to recognize David and the hand of God with him. Now, in verse 12, so David knew that the Lord had established him as king. That's number one. Number two, and that he had exalted his kingdom. Who had? God had. And then third, he did it for the sake of his people, Israel. David receives a lot of praise on this occasion. But he says the praise rightly goes to God, who's made us what we are. Now in verse 13, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he had come from Hebron. Also more sons and daughters were born to David. David, unfortunately, seems to have handled trials better than he handled success. Because now in his success, he starts doing the very opposite of what Deuteronomy 17 says he's to do. One of the three great prohibitions is you're not to get horses, not to get gold. You're not to multiply wives to yourself. Deuteronomy 17. Kings, don't multiply wives to yourselves. I've suggested that chapter 6, his ignorance about who's to carry the ark and how they're to carry it is equal to this ignorance, and probable, in my opinion, because he's been out running from Saul all these years and not studied the way he should. But whatever you can say about that, it starts to show an illustration here, as it always does in polygamy. It looks like present success. He's so successful, he can get wife after wife. Maybe some of these are military wives, in that they form alliances. You would marry a woman from Egypt, and then there's no way Pharaoh is going to come and attack you. Marry a woman from Syria, there's no way the king of Syria is going to come and attack you. So it's a means of carrying out alliances. Maybe that's why Solomon had so many. However that may be, the present success will very shortly turn into future failure and absolute misery for David, just like it did everyone else. So regardless of his greatness, there was a weakness here. It tells us their names. Verse 14, these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem. Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon. All four of those had a mother named Bathsheba. 1 Chronicles 3, verse 5. These four were the children of Bathsheba. 1 Chronicles 3, 5. And then Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. And then it takes us to the Philistine, serious Philistine threat. Let me say a couple of things about Hiram, king of Tyre, before we go. He wants good relations with the king of Israel. He will do the same things we pointed out with Solomon. Israel dominated the inland trade routes to Tyre. There were reasons why they would work together. Tyre is wonderful on the sea. Israel had great commerce because they're a natural trade route from north and south going right through Israel for land traffic. And so Hiram needed the food that Israel could provide. Israel needed the woodworking that they had all around this land of Tyre. Also, Tyre was dependent on Israelite agriculture for much of its food. You see this with King Herod in Acts 12, verse 20. They come doing everything but saying he's the God who created them. And he takes praise as a God. They say blasphemous words, and he accepts it in order to start the contracts going again. He'd cut them off. And then a close relationship existed between the same two realms until the Babylonian invasion. Okay. This brings us then to David and the Philistines, and it also brings us to 5 minutes. So we'll see what we can do in 5 minutes on this chapter. It tells us in verse 17, when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. What's Philistines' problem? Well, in 1 Samuel 31, they had conquered this land. They conquered Israel. Just as Israel conquered the nations that were there, the Jebusites and Girgashites and all these other ites. Now, they've conquered the Israelites. So it's their land. They've killed the king. They killed his sons. It's theirs. And now this David, as long as he's in the civil war, they don't do anything. He'll just fizzle out. Somebody will kill him like they did Ishbosheth and so on. They know about these things. But it's not happening. They made him the king of all. They're behind David. So now they know he is a real threat. So during the civil war, Israel would destroy itself. They were very weak. The Philistines were strong. Now that they're united, their strength and unity, and that poses a threat to Philistia. Now they get busy with their war adventures. So They went up to search for David. David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Some versions will use the word fortress there. Now you have two major battles here. Verse 18, starting, the Philistines also went and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. Now, this is the little inset that's enlarged there, but you'll notice the valley of Rephaim right here. Rephaim means the valley of the giants. I don't know that there were any more giants still living here, but David gets in a stronghold and he goes to attack these people in this valley, the Philistines. And he does a very good job of it. It tells us that in verse 19, he inquired of the Lord. Now, what's unusual about that? Well, it's been 40 years since we've seen a king do that, hasn't it? So that's one thing that's unusual about it. And David will do it every time he faces a battle or an opponent. He says, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand? Notice, it's all on God. Whatever you want, that's what I'll do. And the Lord said to David, go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hand. Now, verse 20. So David went to Baal Perazim. Okay. You may have a footnote on Baal Perazim. Baal can mean Lord or Master. It can mean husband. It can mean Lord in a godly sense. It can mean the name of one of their gods, Baal. But here, the master, God is the master, and Perazim means to break through something, to break out. Baal Perazim means the Lord of the breakouts, or the breakthroughs. We need a breakthrough in our defeat of the Philistines. So, David went to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there, and he said, the Lord has broken through, there's he's defining those terms, Baal Perazim, the Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breakthrough of water. The enemy's all ready to fight, and all of a sudden this huge tonnage of water comes and just sweeps them all away. That's what it's like fighting against God. I don't recommend it. So he called the name of that place Baal Perazim. Now, verse 21. And they left their images there, and David and his men carried them away. Bless their hearts. They had the awfulest time with Dagon. It kept falling down and hurting itself. And now they're having the same problem with these gods. The Philistines need better gods, don't they? They just couldn't face the God of Israel. What a lesson this was to them and to all of Israel. So they left their images behind. It's every man for himself, and it's every god for himself. Their images couldn't even save themselves, much less the people who trusted in them. So it's really humorous here. So they left their images there. David and his men carried them away. Now, the second attempt, the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. Therefore, David inquired of the Lord. Now, wait a minute. He did that in verse 19 at the first battle. Why does he inquire again? Because this is a second attack. And he needs God as much now as he did then. He's going to trust God every battle of his life, every step of the way. At least, that's his plan. And so, David inquired. He said, you shall not go up. Same enemy, but different plan. You shall not go up. Circle around behind them and come upon them in front of the mulberry trees. Same enemy, but he still consults God. Now, mulberry or five or six other trees have been suggested. I have no clue what these trees look like. It's from a word that means weeping. And it makes you think that these trees shed some kind of a, what would you call it when they shed some sap, maybe, and were wet? I don't know. But in verse 24, it should be, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly. For then the Lord will go out before you to strike the camp of the Philistines. There is human and divine joint participation. The human acts when the divine gives the order. God says, go now. And that's what they did. David did so as the Lord commanded him, and he drove back the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. And so that take, well, let me just mention Gezer. The Philistines have been encroaching on the land. Now they're going back the opposite way. It's amazing what can happen when you trust God and do things His way. All right, any comments? Okay, thank you everybody for your help tonight.